Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the worst anti-Semitic of them all? Through tales of hate that time retells, it's Rachel Zeller who tops the spell. Hello, everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is the Red, White, and Rude, where politics and culture collide. Because we all know politics is downstream of culture, which means whatever happens in the real world culturally, as in entertainment, music, movies, etc., eventually dribbles on down to become political. I hope you like my little intro. That's what today's main storyline is going to be. We are going to talk about Snow White and the Seven Hobos and the PR disaster that has become. Then we're going to talk about Michelle Obama's big flop. And I'm not talking about it when they refer to her as Michael and the flop. I'm kidding, people. Don't kill me. Well, I'm okay with that aspect because I'm not talking about Hillary. But we're going to talk about her podcast and the honest truth that the Obamas never truly had relevance in terms as they were America's greatest virtue signaling couple in their support. A mainstream media created couple and power, and they did wield it. But we've seen how that has gone through Obama's endorsements and through the sagging lack of relevance they've had since they left office. Then we're going to talk about an update to the Blake Lively, Justin Baldoni saga. And then we're going to close it out with what is becoming our viewers' favorite topic or segment, and that is the Rude Rundown, where I take a look at various topics happening in America as well as around the world and break them down in a timely fashion. But before we go on, do not forget to like and share this podcast. Okay, you can wait till the end of the podcast. Make sure you like and share it. But also, make sure you bookmark grumblingsmedia.com, which is where you can find this podcast, my political conservative podcast. I do two of those, Fired Up and Fired Up California, and my sports podcast. I made my bones in the fantasy industry to help commercialize it and to help pioneer it. Those player profiles you see, my company, right about the same time a RotoWire came out with that, the difference is I owned literally every contract to every major player with those player news. So if you play fantasy sports, those were my player news you were watch or reading back in the day until I sold the company. And then I think that's it. Counting this one. Whew, lost track there for a second. But you can find all my podcasts over there at grumblingsmedia.com, as well as YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, y Pandora under the handle Grumblings Media. We truly appreciate your support. We are an all-volunteer group. I do this out of passion. I pretty much got canceled in the fantasy sports industry. There's no going back, I was told by somebody. And so be it. I do this out of passion. But I am trying to turn Grumblings Media into a bit of a business. And because of your help and your support, that appears to be the case of what is happening. So with that said, let's get down to it, my friends. Also, don't forget to comment on these segments. If you don't like it, let me know. Hey, just be forewarned, I push back. Okay, Snow Woke and the Seven PR Disaster, Rachel Ziegler's Magical Meltdown. So let's talk about the context of the film and what this controversy is about. So Disney's live-action Snow White, it's set for release this upcoming week, I believe, and it's going to reimagine the 1937 classic, but it's mired in controversy literally since day one because of a dumb, little, stupid, ignorant fool. And how today's social media works has created a massive dilemma for Walt Disney. And it's not the first time this has happened, but this could be a tipping point. And it's obviously what I'm talking about is just woke comments anti-Semitic comments. In my opinion, they were. You know, she'll deny them, but they were in my opinion. And this was all done by the lead actress, Rachel Zegler. So Zegler clearly outspoken. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry is outspoken behind a computer where they believe they're 700-pound gorillas. So she has her political stances, her disdain for the original Snow White, and there's Cassian issues of this. And it's all overshadowed the film's narrative. And it's polarizing fans, and it's threatening Disney's family-friendly brand. Again. Again. I can keep saying again, 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 over and over. Because this is like a broken record that Disney still does not want to understand. But I think with their Lucas... their last indie failure, their Star Wars series flopping, the Marvel movies stagnating, Captain America, Brave New Frontier, whatever the hell it's called, being one of the lowest MCU grossing movies, and not likely to even break even. It's just become a nightmare for this company, this corporation. So, some of her comments were on the Israel-Hamas conflict, and particularly a Palestine-supporting post, which many, as I did, interpreted it as being anti-Semitic. And obviously that's calling boycotts of the Walt Disney movie here. She's in Snow White. And let's be honest here, folks. Hollywood's taking a massive hit after hit after hit with these woke movies. I mean, and they still haven't figured it out. I mean, just look at their Oscars, all woke. Lots of woke movies that aren't even making much money. But as far as it being explicitly anti-Semitic, the full transparency, some will say that, will say it wasn't, and I won't argue it, but it's the innuendos. You know, and it ties the tensions with her co-star Gal Gadot, who is an Israeli actress, beautiful woman, and she's known for her military service in the background. And to her credit, Gal Gadot, she's remained quiet. She's a professional. Which means she's going to have a much longer career than Rachel Zegler, who is still looking for that big hit. I think she's been in a hit that was part of an ensemble, but everything else is pretty much tanked. Her best known one, I believe, may have been West. Oh my God, I'm drawing a blank here. The gang one, the gang musical one, West something. You know, West Side Story. Duh. You know, just ironically, a little tidbit is she is Colombian. I am Panamanian, but technically I could be seen as Colombian as well because Panama was part of Colombia and we gained our freedom as a people and then becoming a country because of Roosevelt and Imperial America. You know. So anyway, sources describe a strained on-set relationship with Disney insiders calling Zegler a PR nightmare. Over all this fallout. You know, she criticized the 1937 films Romance and Gender Roles. She dismissed the prince as a stalker, and she keeps pushing a leadership-focused Snow White. Bleep, that Snow White isn't going to do squat, but wait for that prince's kiss. You know, her disdain for the original's outdated narrative has been labeled as woke. You know, just appreciate it. It was a different time, different era, but it's also from a patriarchal society, which is what we are starting to not be, but that success historically has shown where there's a patriarchal society and there's respect given to the matriarchy and the roles. Lots of good things happen, and there's nothing wrong with a woman who wants to work. But feminazism was born out of the fact that they took feminism, which was a woman having the ability to make a choice for her to decide what she wants to do with her life. Feminazism was born out of being a mom is bad. You want to be a career or you're not a feminist. And that's when things really went south for women in terms of alienating oneself, in terms of destroying, trying to destroy the patriarchy. And we've seen the country's gone to hell economically, ideologically, culturally. It's pretty much that simple. And I talk a bit about that in my last podcast, Fired Up, which I live streamed just the other night. So social media has successfully been reflecting a go woke, go broke mantra sentiment. And with Zegler doubling down on critics, that's escalating these tensions. And Disney from Lightyear, whatever that Toy Story character is called. I want to say Gordon Lightfoot. Buzz Lightyear flopping to literally every other movie flopping and to even certain movies not doing as well as they should have. See Marvel Comics Universe. So tensions are escalating. So let's talk about cultural appropriation. So as a Colombian American, Zegler's casting as her traditionally European Snow White has sparked accusations of race swapping and cultural appropriation. And this has come about because of Hollywood purposely and intentionally doing this. And when it's done to black characters, which is rarely if ever in today's modern day era, it's the end of the world. It's whitey this, whitey that. And then Latinos have jumped on board. It's okay to be racist against whites. Every culture is. And so this happened. This hatred has happened, including cornrows. I saw that rise again. Are people that stupid? They think over thousands of years that man has been around, that they weren't in their caves messing with their hair and braiding it? It's like, please, please. So the point here, though, is anglers are saying, well, she's Colombian. She's not even white. She doesn't even embody what Snow White is. And I see a lot of black conservatives echoing the same thing. So this isn't just a cultural issue. It's about respecting the ownership. And my take is simple. Create your own characters. Luke Cage, who we're going to talk about here for a second, Hero for Hire, Power Man, Hero for Hire, was created as a black man. Instead of somebody appropriating Luke Cage, they created El Tigre, a Latino version of the Black Panther in the barrio. So that's how you should do it, you know. Instead, they try to sit there. They even did it with Spider-Man, the multiverse. Spider-Man was a Latino when Stan Lee had those first few issues. Then all of a sudden, they transformed him. You know, so this cultural appropriation seems to go one way, and it's not being liked anymore when situations like this rise. Right or wrong, that's what it boils down to. So defenders argue it's an inclusive choice, but her reinterpretation of the role as a modern figure intensifies the claims of imposing identity politics on a folktale. And they're absolutely right. That's exactly what she's doing. You look at her timeline. It's clear as day. So in honor of this, I wanted to present to you some of my thoughts on some future big-time movies. First up on the docket here, and I will present to you Mr. Chris Pratt as Bruce Lee. Wah! Hey, I know Jeet Kune Do, and I actually learned it from one of the individuals who actually attended the Wednesday night school that Bruce Lee would attend at times after he shut down the studio. So I'm very familiar with Bruce Lee, what he represents. That's a kick-ass picture of Chris Pratt. Wah! So let us move on. Now, Warners. I think they did the last one. Think about that. That would be y'all would sit there and not have to worry about your solvency the way you're going. You wouldn't have to worry about your DC universe dying on you as it is. Okay, so let's go to Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, aka Power Man, a man born and bred of the ghetto, fighting for Black America. Well, I believe this would be a massive hit with Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, starring Brad Pitt. I even put him in with a little darker skin under the tanning booth there. And from there, we are not done, my friends. We are not done, because we are going to be looking at the one, the only, to be judged by your character and not your skin. And with that, I present to you the man from down under, the almighty God, Thor, Chris Hemsworth as MLK Jr. So honestly, I don't believe none of this. I would never go see any of this, because these are people who come from a specific culture, or the characters were created with a specific culture and identity in mind. So my point is to the hypocrisy of when Black America gets angry when it's done, when they say white America is culturally appropriating, and then you turn around and go, what's the big deal when it's done to non-Black characters of history, such as Cleopatra, who was not Black, and they come back, what's the big deal? her life would not have been what it was had she been. You know, if MLK had been white, you think his life would have been? No. So there's certain characters, whether fiction or nonfiction, that were created with a certain cultural reference tied to it. So no, whitewashing or whatever the term is wrong. And Zeller, I don't care that she's Snow White. My issue is actually that Gal Gadot is actually prettier than her. You never, ever, ever. No, let me hear share screen. You never, ever make the star not as pretty as, you never make the protagonist not as pretty as the antagonist in a show like Snow White. So there's Zegler, heavily makeup, heavily airbrushed, kind of made them look cartoonish a bit. That's her. And then you have Gal Gadot as Eva Queen. And it's night and day, you know? Damn it. Sorry about that, people. It's night and day in terms of the beauty. Uh-oh, something happened here. Apologies for that, but you never make her as... You never make the antagonist prettier than the protagonist, and that's what's the case here, you know? And it's actually... a shame. But that was my issue. My whole issue with the cultural appropriation, it's ignorant, it's stupid, and it's easy to poke fun at. And it's unnecessary. All it does is create greater racism. You know, and they're doing it with Harry Potter and one of the characters. And then I think the character gets killed by being hung by a tree. Now, how's that going to play with a black guy being hung by the tree, according to how the book was written? Not very good, my friends. So her woke rhetoric, Zegler, clashes with Disney's historically conservative, family-oriented audience. And obviously, it's already risking boycotts and suppressed turnout. You know, so, and people are saying we're not going to watch it. I wouldn't watch it regardless. Heck, I still have to see Deadpool and Wolverine. I just got so turned off with Ryan Gosling and his fight with his arrogance and his abuse of his power and who he is in the Baldoni case. What a cuck. So the legacy versus the modernization tension. So she wants to fix how the original, to modernize it from a woke standpoint. And some see it as Disney erasing its heritage and with Zegler as the face of that shift. And this mirrors the backlash against other remakes. But her combative tone alone amplifies this divide. I mean, she's an idiot. So what's Disney's response? And then this is a massive PR crisis. You'll find out why in a moment. So Disney has entered damage control. They canceled the UK premiere. They limited press access to avoid further PR disaster from Ziegler's unscripted remarks in the US premiere. There are bans on certain media outlets and it's tightly scripted interviews. And that just shows how panicked they are over the narrative control. And here's the other issue I believe is going to happen. I believe Disney and other studios, they're going to have report cards on how much they can trust some of these actors and actresses from destroying and ruining films. And I think you're going to see a complete shift in Marvel Comics heroes and the actors and actresses who play them. And you're going to see contracts being signed. When this movie's in production, yada, 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 so being done, you can't say or talk about this. The courts have already ruled on this and they sided with the studios when, ex-Madonna, Bad Boys, show. What's his name? Let me see. Sean Penn. That's who I was thinking of. He took a, I can't remember what studio the court, and then the court was like, no, you're how you act off camera or what you say can stunt the growth or the viewership of this movie. And I think they've got a strong leg to stand on. So I think they are doing that. They're creating report cards. And I think Zegler's done. Zegler, I think she's done. So internally, there's frustration. An unnamed actor confirmed Disney saw Zegler's liability pre-premiere, and they nearly fired her over the Gadot tensions, and they should have. And then once the anti-Semitism claims came out, they should have just dumped her. You know, unlike past stars, her social media amplifies unfiltered opinions and the contrast with Disney's tight PR management and what they want to portray and why they became a behemoth. So controversy shifts from the storytelling to Ziegler's persona, and it undermines the nostalgia, and Snow White had broad appeal until she came aboard. So they have a history of not being able to salvage loss. Think of the Lone Ranger. And that all came out with Johnny Depp playing an Indian. He wasn't an Indian. Think of Buzz Lightyear with a LGBT storyline. And they didn't have to have that. That would have been a blockbuster had they not. These are issues that parents want to talk to their children about. They don't want Disney talking to them at an age that's not appropriate. And that's what the woke-ism of Hollywood has done. So why is this a dire issue? Well, they've probably lost billions over the last 10 years, Disney. And they were worth billions, and it's cut deep into their pocketbooks and their bottom line. So here's what I found out. The budget is anywhere from $209.3 million to $269.4 million. And the reason it's gotten that high, it's been inflated by reshoots, having to fix bad crap, CGI issues, talent costs, and delays tied to the backlash, adding pressure. They were hoping to bury the film and hope she would die down, but she wouldn't. She won't shut up. So they're looking at a potential 50 to 100 million write down, kind of like what they did with John Carter of Mars about 10, 15 years ago. So Disney's also targeting about a 50 to 70 million domestic opening. And Snow White, I'm not sure how much worldwide traction she has, but she's known worldwide. So that's actually a very good opening. You know, the thing is if the story can carry itself with strong legs. Captain America, Brave New World had a great opening, but it had no legs. Reviews were dismal, et cetera, et cetera. And it's dying to slow down. I think it had less than $10 million made this weekend. And it's only been on its fourth week, I think. So there's something called a three-time formula. So the box office must triple budget to break even. Snow White needs between $627.9 million to $808.2 million globally to succeed. I don't see that happening. That's why they're already predicting a write-down for this movie. You know, and let's compare. Cinderella in 2015 earned $543 million, but it was a $95 million budget. So it literally had to earn a slightly less than $300 million worldwide to break even. So it did make a profit, you know. So this is going to be a tough hoe to hoe, or whatever the saying is. So negative PR and boycotts, that may limit its international appeal. It's going to limit its American appeal, especially in conservative markets. And competition in 2025 and diminished hype could further depress the earnings, threatening Disney's investment. I don't care how good it opens. If it doesn't have legs, the move forward, meaning good reviews and good word of mouth, it's doomed. And even if it isn't, I don't see it breaking $800 million. Not based upon the hoopla. And there you have it. There you have it, my friends. Snow Woke and the 7 PR Disaster. Rachel Zegler's magical meltdown may destroy the Magic Kingdom's most prized possession, Snow White. Okay, let's move on to Michelle Obama's podcast, Flopped Hard, Proving Media's created saint can't save a dumpster fire. Hell, she's become the dumpster fire. So Michelle Obama's latest podcast is stirring the pot. Numbers are all over the place. So from 14,000 to 20,000 views, the people are talking about whether it's a hit or a miss. It's a miss. She has nearly 100 million followers. That's less than 1% of her followers listening to that show. It's like 0.00-something percent. So here's the straight scoop. I'm sorting out all the noise. So her new podcast is co-hosted with her brother, Craig Robinson. And my God, that they look like twins. Now I get where all the Michael jokes come from. It's not Michael. It's Michelle dressing red drag. Again, I'm kidding. People say, William, why do you go there? Because it's such low-hanging fruit. You can't help yourself. You know. But anyway, they launched the podcast. And I'm not kidding. I am not kidding. You got to see these two. Here, let me show you. You cannot tell me that does not look like twins. It really does, doesn't it? And that's Craig Robinson, her brother. So they launched what is supposedly a family-oriented or family story-focused podcast, but it obviously has hit a rough patch. Reports citing, again, 14,000 views for the Issa Rae episode in 24 hours, and a debut episode ranging from 12 to 20,000 views in 14 to 15 hours. Needless to say, it's not a big hit, and it's likely not to have legs. My issue with this, well, it's not really an issue. One of my takes is that she's a product of the mainstream media having built her up. If you said anything denigrating or disagree with Obama, you were deemed a racist. So for 8 years, and they also blame Bush for everything. 8 years they were still blaming Bush. And she's purely a PR creative machine. And I say that because when you look at Obama's endorsements, not most, but over 50% of them lost. And then his statement to black men saying, pretty much calling them stupid for not voting for Kamala and then accusing them of not voting for her because she's a woman, kind of, they all went off on them. So with that said, these numbers don't shock me. You know, so the family chatter, it's a big departure from her usual big stage presence. I mean, nobody attended here. Kind of reminds me of Biden and Hillary's campaigns where they had to do the tight close-ups to make it look like there were a lot of people, you know. So they were obviously betting on the siblings' vibes to pull listeners in. Fail. The family chatter premise it has generated nothing in terms of excitement. In fact, the comments like, nobody asked for this, and it reflects a negative response to the episodes. And it's to the point that the comment section is so brutal, with 90% of them being negative, it's eventually going to facilitate whoever's in charge of the comment section to shut them, or rather turn them off, which is another blow. That will be seen as a defeat. And some see her banking on casual tales and comments, dissing on her husband, Obama. And truth of the matter, he's better liked than she is in many regards, and she's completely misreading her audience. So I never believed they had gravitas from the get-go, but let's say they did. Well, she no longer has that gravitas. And despite, I think what they're trying to do is get on the podcast bandwagon. Look, this is hard work. I've been doing it for nearly a couple of years, and we've gone from single-digit viewers to a few thousand, and we're still way off from our goal. And we're exponentially growing now. We're seeing our subscribers really jumping up. So we're getting after 2 years, and we're still still a tadpoles in the ocean. You know, so she's not going to be able to keep this up. You know, and you know what? I think she's trying to placate the crowd that loves to hear dirt, you know. But look, in her defense, she's not the only leftist celebrity who's in a podcast rut. Gavin Newsom and Meghan Markle, boy, they're also scraping by. Though Newsom did have 743,000 views in his episode with Charlie Kirk, which dwarfs her 14 to 20,000. But Newsom's views came because of Kirk and the confrontation. That will eventually diminish. Why do I say that? Newsom's had TV show and other podcasts that have failed or are irregular. You know. So, her podcast numbers underlie a broader trend. Fame doesn't guarantee listens in a packed and saturated field. You got to work it. So I don't know what's going to make her stand out. What's going to give her a winning edge? But then again, when it's virtue signaling in follower count, those may be her real numbers. And what I'm talking about in terms of how many people are actually interested. It's kind of like her book. The big joke was she sold millions of books, but yet only had a few thousand that actually read it. And how do we know this? When we would quiz people about the contents in the book, they wouldn't even know because they bought the book, put it on the shelf. That's how you can tell when somebody's read the book. Find a couple of tidbits that are juicy, ask them about it, and when they – let me do my Karen Bass imitation. When they ask anybody about if they read one of her books. I saw that played out a few times. Yeah. So what's a bigger picture? The podcast flatlands with a wink and a nudge. It's like a neighbor gossiping over the fence about how the fancy folks like Michelle keep missing the mark with regular Joes. The point being the turbo analogy I just gave you there. In essence, it's she's not able to relate to the everyday Joe. You know, she's an elitist. She comes across as an elitist. She will always be an elitist. So these digs aren't just for hot air. The numbers show that what I'm saying has validity to it. People are fed up with the Obamas. They're fed up with the media golden children, meaning the elitist Newsom, Obama, Kamala, acting like they own the playground. And they're just tired of it. And they've moved on. Michelle doesn't realize that everybody's moved on. Now, one thing I want to talk about, though, is perception versus reality. You know, I wasn't on a recent podcast. My podcast that I did, one of the guests claimed conservatives focused on Michelle Obama. That's our version of Trump derangement syndrome. It's not. I rejected it outright. No, it's not TDS, like the left unhinged CNN rants over Trump. It's a calculated pushback against her overblown hype. It's not some mere fixation. She looms as a media-anointed 2028 threat, which she may or may not be, but her podcast viewership shows she's no political beast. She has no following. She's just a figurehead anointed by the mainstream media, just like Kamala was. So the mainstream press think glowing Vogue covers, PBS tributes, it paints her as flawless. Yet her podcast triviality, I would tag it First Lady Whining, as Ben Shapiro did, or rather I would agree with Ben Shapiro. And she's also tone deaf. Her 2020 claim of living in a low-grade depression during COVID lockdowns, where she had all the freedom compared to everyone else to go where she wanted, when she wanted, that was mocked. Dinesh D'Souza led that, but all of us mocked her as an elitist because it's low-hanging fruit. She's like a political piñata. Bam, bam, bam. You can hit it easily, blindfolded. You know, her water-walking image is crafted by 8 years of adulation like her 2016 DNC halo. But the real flop is those 14,000 views. It exposes a media construct, not her, and opposes her raw ability or lack of one. So we chafe at her because she's a press-driven persona, decades of liberal outlets propping her up, and her podcast stumble is a reality that challenges and proves the virtue signaling, the mainstream media propping her up, all the covers, all the lies stated about her, and being royalty, all of that was a fraud. So that's the deal. Michelle Obama's podcast is clocking 14 to 20,000 views, depending on who's counting. It's tangled in the celebrity podcast slump of leftist celebrities. And it's served with a dash of sharp commentary that nobody cares about. What's going to happen in the future? We'll wait and see. But I'm pretty sure this podcast won't last a year from now. All right. Let's move on to Blake versus Justin. Hollywood's now hush, hush, SmackDown heats up. So, we've got a juicy side story of today's podcast that's been making waves in Hollywood. It's the latest twist, my friends, in the ongoing legal saga between Blake Lively, living off the coattails of Ryan Reynolds, and Justin Baldoni. Oh, God, that guy's a creep. He is so feminist. It's sickening. But the Deadline article talked about it last week, and this wasn't the main event, Snow White was, but I've been giving updates. I've talked about this. I just couldn't let this one go. It's a courtroom drama, celebrity stakes, and there's a judge trying to keep a lid on it now. So Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni, for those who don't know, there's allegations of sexual harassment and then retaliation from their time working on It Ends With Us. The trial is set for May of 2026. Both sides are entrenched in a bitter fight, with Lively and kingmaker Ryan Reynolds seeking confidentiality so they can control the narrative, while Baldoni's camp claims a partial win in this Lively victory because it also limits what she can say. She's trying to play the victim, the sexual assaulted victim, and she's not. There's enough evidence that has disproven that and has completely swayed the audience, the followers reading this, studying this, to realize Blake Lively lied, and she lied with the New York Times help. Now, that's how I interpret everything. The courts may come up with something different, you know. So this past week, a federal judge, Louis J. Liman, he rejected Baldoni's bid for full evidence access and granted Lively's attorney's eyes only protective order to safeguard sensitive info like trade secrets and personal details. But this extends to her. I guarantee you she's going to break that. And once she breaks it, he's going to break it, then she can take him to court, then he's going to prove that she broke her side, and it's going to become a mess with the judge having to play parent. Again, it's not a full victory that Lively wanted. The order limits her ability to publicly disclose details. And it binds both parties of silence outside the courtroom. I don't know why the judge wants to curb leaks in this high-profile case. None of his business. It's all out there. It's Hollywood. But he's trying to, because she wanted a request to it. And he's probably a fan of theirs, you know, who nobody knows Baldoni. So, for those who don't know, Lively's team alleges Baldoni and Wayfair Studios orchestrated a smear campaign to muzzle her. It's not true. She actually predicated and started all this with her working hand-in-hand with the New York Times to publish a hit piece at Baldoni. Baldoni's camp fired back, claiming they're the ones wronged, and they were, accusing Lively's side of stealing trade secrets and breaching confidentiality. You're hearing it in these terms because that's how they're going at it in court. You know, you have to understand how things are done from a legal process versus how we talk and what we think can be two completely different beasts, which is why sometimes when decisions are made, you're like, oh, what happened there? Because the legality of issues is maybe completely different than what's being debated in the public forum. You know, so both factions were vying to paint themselves as a righteous underdog. And there's only one faction in that role per the public's backing, and that's Baldoni. And that's why Lively's doing this. She wants to stop the bleeding. Because every time he brings out another text, video, it destroys Lively. So she wants to be able to scream everything she can and wants to shut him up. And the judge did not have that. She gets a partial edge by restricting Baldoni's access, but it's a double-edged sword, as I said. Neither she nor Baldoni can freely spill their side to the press. As I said, she's going to break that. So there's hundreds of millions in damages and reputation at stake, and this protective order sets up a tense march to trial. This is going to be a Amber Heard, Johnny Depp trial. It's going to be standing room only there, and it's going to be high ratings TV. So the courtroom battle might stay under wraps, but the simmering PR war could still erupt. So there you have it. That's the latest chapter. It's going to be more to come in the Blake Lively versus Justin Baldoni saga. That one's courtesy of Deadline. It's a tangled web. Look, tangled web of legal moves and muted victories. Both sides gag, but they're still swinging it as they head towards 2026 showdown. We're going to keep tabs on this. And there you have it. Those are the three main stories I wanted to talk about today. So let's get down to it. What is one of my favorite segments? The Rude Rundown, where I take a lightning round type look at, as lightning round as my slow self can get, and talk about what's happening around the nation, around the world. So let's get to it. The Rundown number one, shocking murder plot rocks Ghost Adventure star's marriage. This one blew me away. So the paranormal world of Ghost Adventures, woo, that took a dark turn, people, when Aaron Goodwin's wife, Victoria, was arrested for allegedly orchestrating a murder for hire plot against him. I thought I was in a good marriage. So she's the wife. Victoria Goodwin is the wife of Ghost Adventure star Aaron Goodwin, reality show of sorts. And she was arrested March 6th in Clark County, Nevada. She's facing charges of soliciting and conspiring to murder after allegedly plotting with a Florida inmate to kill her husband for $11,515 while he filmed this show. We're not talking big dollar here, man. That inmate, woo! Boy, he needs an agent to get himself a better deal. So despite a seemingly happy marriage showcased on social media, Aaron was blindsided, and Victoria denied the intent to kill him. Oh, no, it's just a misunderstanding. When I said I want you to kill him, I just meant kill him with love. She claimed she was fantasizing and thought payments were for cell phones, highlighting a big gap between what's being reported in the media and what the police are charging with what she's saying. So my take, look, this is jaw-dropping betrayal. And it echoes a similar scandal from Married at First Sight, Season 11, where a participant's hidden motives unraveled post-show. Okay, there's no direct ties to that, but it does parallel another reality show. So it does underscore the chilling reality that love can blind you to red flags like potential affairs or deceit, and it's obviously left Aaron's world shattered. It's a devastation I've witnessed in the Navy, where ulterior motives masked as affection destroy lives and finances. And so let me talk about both points here. There's always red flags when you look at it. Taxes, phone calls, eating, getting in shape, just all kinds of red flags. And then I've also seen it from the military stance, where the woman would marry the sailor, or some of them were still virgins, not the most handsomest, to get to America, at which point they would stay married for about 10 years, where they could get divorced, collect the check. In the meantime, they're bringing their family over through the husband's name. You know, so I've seen that racket too many times for anybody to go, are you sure? No, it happens more than not. Maybe not 40, 50, 60%. Well, maybe it is 40, 50, 60%, you know, but it's very high. So, and these people, they're just blind to what's happening. As Aaron here was. Rundown number two. Gene Hackman's estate faces potential family dispute after wife's unexpected death. So we all know about Gene Hackman and his passing of he and his wife, how his wife passed approximately a week before he did, and he just probably died of starvation and everything else to go with it. He had dementia so badly, he was probably like a two-year-old child. I say that having seen it, having worked in that industry. So Hackman has an $80 million estate, and that's at the center of all this controversy. Because his wife, Betsy Arakawa, she was named the sole beneficiary in his will. And that left his three children from a previous marriage, Christopher, Elizabeth, and Leslie, without any direct inheritance, unless they contest the will under state laws. And they will, because Betsy died before Gene, which would have nullified the will, I guess. I don't know if it would have nullified. Yeah. So the complexity of all of this estate planning stems from, again, Arakawa predeceasing him by about a week. There's no clear contingency in his will for this scenario. That means the courts are going to be involved. So Hack and the courts, the state has no right to this money because there are living heirs. So which heir gets it is where a potential battle could brew. So for those of you, just remind you, Hackman died of heart disease and Alzheimer's related issues. He died of Alzheimer's because his Alzheimer's what prevented him from getting care. If he didn't have Alzheimer's and had a heart disease, he would still be able to function and call for help. You know, she died from hantavirus pulmonary syndrome. She probably got it from mice. They're older. You know, they had animals living out there in the ranch, so probably mice somehow. So this leaves his $80 million estate open to claims by his three children. And under interstate laws, everything's dependent on the will's terms. And since the will's all messed up because she died first, the courts are going to have to settle it out. This could be settled. This situation could turn messy, revealing possible resentment between Hackman and his children that they weren't in the will. From my research, they didn't see him for long periods at a time. And with her death prior to his death, throwing all this into chaos. The siblings might fight over the shares, though a swift split is possible if they cooperate. It would make for a bittersweet, dramatic coda to Hackman's reclusive life. It's reminiscent of the flair in his films, to be honest. Yet one he likely never foresaw as a writer of books. Something this out of nowhere. It's like, I would not believe that if I read it in a book type scenario. His death, how it happened, the siblings, all of that. So I think it's going to get resolved. Unless these siblings hate one another. But I think it will get resolved. Rundown number three. Don Robinson's fall from En Vogue stardom raises questions about fame and finances. So Don Robinson, a founding member of the iconic 90s R&B group En Vogue, my era, she recently revealed in a YouTube video that she's been living in her car for 3 years. Obviously, that sparked a lot of shock speculation about her journey from superstardom to this unexpected chapter. So En Vogue was a dominant force in the early 90s with multi-platinum albums like Born to Sing and Funky Divas, and reportedly in earning the industry over $20 million in sales. So the downside is the members allegedly received pennies per album, potentially less than 1% of profits. And that highlights the stark disparity between their cultural impact and their personal earnings. So here's what you need to know. So a lot of blacks decided to create their own record albums because they accused white albums legitimately of doing this. Here's the problem. Motown did this to a lot of their singers. Michael Jackson left because he had beef with Berry Gordy. So it wasn't just, it was the industry. I'm not defending anybody. I'm saying this was not due to skin or ethnicity. This was due to the power you had when you were the owner of the distribution of these albums and sales, et cetera, et cetera, and even airplay. So when a lot of black hip hop artists took over, they did the same thing. So this is something that has been ongoing that needs to end. How? I don't know. You think somebody honest would come along. That said, Robinson frames her car living as a deliberate choice after researching car life communities, insisting it's liberating experience rather than a sign of distress. Her narrative does hint at instability, people. She moved from her parents' home in Las Vegas because of tension with her mom to a hotel stint that was funded by a controlling manager before landing in her car in Malibu in 2022. I'll say this, though. She was probably able to escape the fires. So this situation obviously reignites debate about the music industry's treatment of artists as En Vogue's massive success, selling over 20 million records, contrasts sharply with Robinson's current reality. Obviously, I'm suggesting predatory contracts or mismanagement may have left her with little financial security, despite the group's wealth generation. My take, what the hell happened to Don Robinson's money? En Vogue raked in millions as a top-tier 90s act, yet here she is living in her car. It's a sad twist that smacks of either shady advisors, vile and evil record labels, wild spending, or drugs. There's no evidence of the latter. Although, if she's secretly loaded and just chasing an opiate adventure, more power to her. Otherwise, this is a gut punch cautionary tale for entertainers everywhere. Rundown number 4, Twitch's controversial ban decision, Hassan Abi versus Ethan Klein. So Twitch is owned by Amazon, and they are more pro-leftist than anything else, just like YouTube is. So their recent moderation decisions have sparked obvious debate as political commentator Hassan Abi Piker was unbanned after just one day following a suspension. And it's speculated to stem from violent rhetoric against Senator Rick Wilson, while Ethan Klein faced a 30-day ban for streaming his Content Nuke video that showcased Hassan Abi. You're like, whoa, he was streaming what the guy said, and he gets banned for 30 days? I'm like, if I have a lawyer, I'm looking into that. And if I'm the DOJ, I'm looking into Twitch and targeting political opponents. I don't. There's probably some issues with that legally. And why? It's a disparity in punishment. Hassan Abi's brief suspension versus Klein's month-long ban for rebroadcast of Hassan Abi's own words. That's fueled accusations of favoritism, political ideological favoritism. Even Elon Musk weighed in a one-word expose, yes, agreeing that Twitch staff should be fired, highlighting perceived bias in how the platform handles controversial content. Look, Twitch is lagging behind YouTube in the gaming streaming race. And they may be shielding Hassan Abi. They've lost podcasters. He's a polarizing leftist figure. And he only faced a one-day ban for wishing harm on conservatives and encouraging it while harshly penalizing Ethan Klein for just replaying the content. It's a double standard that warrants legal scrutiny from the DOJ for equal treatment, especially given Jeff Bezos' interest in wanting to be taken in a positive way by the Trump administration. I'm pretty sure if Trump says something and makes that phone call, something will happen. And it should. Hate has to be smashed and destroyed. He can say it, but it's a private entity and there should be ramifications. And if they're not, well, all those government deals that Amazon's probably tax breaks, etc., should come under scrutiny. Rundown number 5. Netflix faces fan backlash over The Recruit cancellation. So, The Recruit is a spy thriller that after 2 seasons was canceled. And it sparked outrage among subscribers because they argued that the show's demise was unfairly influenced by the overshadowing success and scheduling proximity of The Night Agent. Now, I saw both season 1s of both shows, and then I saw season 2 of The Night Agent. I didn't even bother with The Recruit. And The Night Agent is another spy thriller that premiered its 2nd season just a week prior. So they point to the scheduling misstep, saying it's a key reason for underperformance because viewers may confuse the 2 shows or prioritize the more established Night Agent. They were both came out the same year. So why is one more established? But they're saying that led to diminished viewership and subsequent axing. Look, Let me boil this down. Look, neither the night agent nor the recruit is groundbreaking. Both start with a solid premise, but then they turn silly, unrealistic, and laughable. The night agent's a little bit better, but still barely worth it by the time the ending came. And the recruit is so forgettable, I started to rewatch season one because I forgot what it was about, and I stopped at episode two or three. I finished episode two, and I was like, enough, this is garbage. It's so fake, unrealistic, it's so stupid. And I couldn't muster the enthusiasm for season two. And I believe that's probably what happened to a lot of individuals. So pairing them as back-to-back could have been a slick spy thriller double header if they weren't so mediocre. And honestly, the creator of the shows is, we need to have one more shot at this to do a spinoff movie. Honestly, 90% of Netflix catalog isn't movie theater worthy. It's there and we watch it because we've already paid for it. Rundown number 6, streaming wars, winners and rising costs. So look, the streaming industry's evolution from affordable disruption to a costly consolidated market mirrors the rise and fall of cable television, with major players now posed to dominate the streaming wars. Actually, the aftermath of the streaming wars. So most analysts believe the streaming wars have concluded, with wealthy platforms like Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, and Hulu emerging as victors, driving up subscription costs as they consolidate content and acquire expensive sports and entertainment rights, nearing traditional cable price levels. This highlights a shift from low-cost streaming promises to a fractured, pricier landscape where exclusive content and tiered pricing models signal a future of bundled services, dominated by a few giants, potentially surpassing cable costs within a decade. So what's going to happen here, unlike television, where you could literally get everything on cable and network because you had access to so many channels, you're not going to have that much access here. So you're not going to be able to see Friends on Netflix anymore. And vice, you know, things of that nature. Exclusivity to Netflix. You're not going to see Beverly Hills Cop 4. Axel Foley's Revenge, whatever it was called, because it's a Netflix exclusive. You're not going to be able to see that on Hulu or other places unless they license it out, and maybe they do. But at the end of the day, this article presents something I predicted was inevitable in streaming costs when streaming first started to gain traction, 10 years ago? Not longer. As platforms like Netflix and Amazon bolster by their deep pockets, they absorb sports and wrestling rights, while others like Hulu, already in the high 80s, in terms of price tag to get the cable version of it via streaming, they're paving the way for a consolidated cable-like future that's going to outstrip past prices in 5 to 10 years, proving that the naivety of expecting free or cheap services to last wasn't naive, it was stupid. But then again, they're not teaching people how to critically think in school. And our love for short-term satisfaction overrides any type of critical thinking or long-term analysis. I saw this coming. Analysts saw this coming. Who didn't see it coming are the kids pushing for it. Rundown number 7, Bill Maher critiques Oscars and cancel culture. So Bill Maher, in a recent real-time episode, he dove into how cancel culture and shifting Hollywood language played pivotal roles in the 2025 Oscar. He claims that Emilia Perez, the frontrunner with 13 nominations, they lost all the major awards like Best Picture to Anora, not because of the quality of the movies, but due to the controversy over the star Carla Sofia Gascon. Ex post resurfaced criticizing George Floyd, Muslims, and diversity at the Academy. Now, Bill Maher himself said he's made posts like this and could easily make posts like this. So he questions how he would shift also from the prostitute to sex worker community in terms of some of the dialogue that was happening that night in the wake of Anora's success, which won Best Picture and Best Actress for Mickey Madison. And he also sarcastically notes that director Sean Baker's recurring focus on sex worker narratives. So in essence, we're saying a film about prostitution and how they try to prop it up one at all versus another terrible movie featuring a transgender being the first nominee for Best Actress. And Hollywood itself hated this, but they had to keep their mouth shut as they promoted it because of diversity. So they were caught. So when this came out about the ex post, that was their opening, and they destroyed the movie, and you know, what's the movie called again? I forget. And I've only talked about it a few times. The Emilia Perez, they destroyed it. And Anora won it all. My take, Mars take rings true. Behind Hollywood's public push for Gascon as a groundbreaking trans actress, the industry quietly recoiled from a conservative leaning post, exposing George Floyd as nothing, and I'm being polite when I say a flawed figure. He was just a bad dude. They used those tweets as a conventional excuse to ditch Emilia Perez, despite the fact it was going to dominate the awards. And as far as lifting the prostitution industry, I merely ask, how many of you parents are going to sit down, have a conversation with your daughters, and encourage them to be hookers? Enough said. Running down number 8. Wikipedia shifted left-leaning propaganda. Wikipedia, once a neutral platform for open knowledge, has transformed into a vehicle for advancing left-leaning establishment perspective. And that's asserted by co-founder Larry Sanger in an interview. This one's a little older, but with the hate towards Trump shifting, more hate's going to show up and lies are going to show up on Wikipedia. So he points out that Wikipedia sourcing rules prioritize the mainstream and left-leaning media like CNN and the New York Times. They will not allow right-leaning sources to be used, like Fox News. So you get biased coverage, biased takes. My take is simple. If Section 30 is revised to permit lawsuits against Wikipedia, the site's going to be filing for immediate bankruptcy by being overwhelmed with legitimate lawsuits of false narratives, lies being written about people. They're deliberately promoting fabricated lies that target conservatives and Republicans. And that's a view I've supported here in previous Red, White, and Rude podcasts. I mean, it's exclusive use of far left and left-leaning sources enables what I call election interference. Because when somebody goes to read up on somebody, wow, that's a bad dude. Can't vote for him. And intentional demonization of an opposing ideology, conservatism. We've got to do something about Section 230. And now. And I haven't heard Trump whisper one iota about that. And that's why Facebook, Amazon, with the Washington Post, but all these social media platforms are aligning with Trump. Apple, all of them, because they were hardcore leftists. They don't want Section 230 messed with or other laws. Google's another one, you know? They don't want any of those laws messed with or those regulations, because it's going to open the door to destroying their multi-billion dollar conglomerates. There you have it, the Rude Rundown. And I hope, my friends, you have enjoyed tonight's show, where we talked about Snow White and the Seven Hobos, Michelle Obama's big flop. Yes, that's an innuendo. As well as the Blake Lively Justin Baldoni update. And I'll keep giving you updates on these if anything new comes about. And I hope you enjoyed the Rude Rundown with the various topics. Do not forget, check out this podcast at grumblingsmedia.com. Bookmark it. You can also check out this podcast and others, a whole library, at YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, ePandora, under the handle Grumblings Media. Do not forget to like and share this podcast as well. And until next week, my friends, I am William Dev Pilar for the Red, White, and Rude, and I bid you adieu.